and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee's unanimous vote on the compromise between the White House and the so-called Corker Bill that could determine the fate of the deal that President Obama and the P5 plus one just made with Iran that is expected to be finalized by the end of June. Joining us is Dr. Paul Piller, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University, who was the National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia at the CIA. We will discuss his latest article in The National Interest, America's Not-So-Ultimate Weapon Economic Warfare, and whether those who want to give the Iran deal a chance can overcome the determination of those who want to kill the deal before it is made. Then we'll examine the life sentence of one Blackwater military contractor and 30-year sentences for three others charged with murdering 14 Iraqis in 2007. Author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer Robert Young Pelton, the author of License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, joins us to discuss the sentences that were handed down as Iraq's Prime Minister Abadi arrived in Washington for meetings with President Obama. Then finally, on the eve of Tax Day, we will speak with Chuck Ma, the Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, about efforts by House Republicans this week to eliminate what limited taxes on family capital the richest 1% of the 1% pay, thus creating a permanent class of Americans who never have to work or pay taxes and moving America closer to becoming an aristocracy of inherited wealth rather than the meritocracy the Founding Fathers intended. And joining us now is Dr. Paul Piller, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution. He retired in 2005 from a 28-year career in the U.S. intelligence community as National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. He's the author of Terrorism and U.S. Foreign Policy and Negotiating Peace, War Termination as a Bargaining Process, and is a contributing editor to The National Interest, where he has an article, America's Not So Old Weapon Economic Warfare. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Paul Piller.
Thank you, Ian.
And what's your sense of this unanimous vote in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee? It's being characterized as a compromise. Some people are saying the White House caved in. A number of Democrats are saying that actually it's a good deal. So from what we know about it at this point, what's your reading on it?
I think the opponents of a deal have more reason to be happy than the supporters of a deal. The White House did have to change its position. It was initially opposed to legislation of this type. I think this was partly a vote-counting matter for the White House. They were looking at not being able to hold enough Senate Democrats to oppose the bill. You had people like Senator Kaine of Virginia, a Democrat who had been working with Senator Corker and had repeatedly expressed his view that Congress has to be involved and doing something with this legislation was the best way to do it. I think if there's a positive to it from the White House's point of view, and we may hear more from the White House along this line, it is that, well, some members have been talking about the need for Congress's role to be made clear with legislation of this type. Now the President and the White House can say, okay, you've got your role. Stop talking to me about procedural matters, and let's talk about the substance. You may have heard in the President's press conference down in Panama over the weekend, where half of the questions were about Iran, he made a statement along the lines of, and these were almost his exact words, I hope that the opponents of the deal will not be able to use procedural issues to screw up the deal. And so I think the one positive from the White House is that this procedural issue, they can argue, has now been set aside. Let's argue substance.
So is there, though, a value in having the Congress buy in? In other words, had they not bought in and had to deal with assessing a fait accompli, the understanding, at least the predictions that I've heard, is that, well, you're better off having them buy in. They'd be more disposed to passing it. But on the other hand, do we know the extent to which they're going to be read into the details? Because I have a fear that a lot of that stuff could be leaked to sabotage the deal.
Well, in terms of leaking details to sabotage it, that's one of the very reasons the supreme leader of Iran had argued earlier that he wanted to see the agreement reached all in one fell swoop, rather than this two-stage process whereby we have this framework agreement and then still a couple of more months of negotiating over details, during which time the hardliners, both in the United States and in Iran, can raise as many objections as they can and cause as much mischief as they can to try to derail the deal. Certainly the White House will, in the weeks ahead, be trying to use briefings, including classified briefings, on Capitol Hill to try to contain as much of the mischief as they can. But certainly there is a big potential for that. And as for the general principle of getting congressional buy-in, it's always desirable, of course, to get that buy-in. But I think in counting the heads and counting the votes and looking ahead to any kind of resolution that the Congress might pass after a deal is signed, there isn't much hope, and I don't have a whole lot of hope, for a positive resolution endorsing the deal. I think the best the White House can hope for is no resolution at all, which is a possibility. And perhaps Senator McConnell would not introduce something if he didn't think he could get a good solid majority of disapproval. Or the second best thing, a resolution of disapproval that the president vetoes and the veto is upheld rather than overridden. Those sorts of scenarios are hardly the stuff of which a good, reassuring congressional buy-in are made.
But it looks as though the president couldn't get the 67 votes to override a veto, but in the compromise deal, it's the threshold is 60 votes.
Well, I mean, the key people are these Democrats, especially Senate Democrats, but also in the House, who are saying, people like Senator Kaine, who among those who were on the committee to vote in favor of this today, saying, look, this vote in favor of the procedural issue, the Corker bill, is not the same as a vote on substance.
Sure.
There will be a lot of pro-agreement people who will remind people like Senator Kaine of those words when it comes time to vote on the substance later on.
And do you think that it made a difference that that Senator Cardin is the the minority chair of the committee, as opposed to Menendez, who is now facing indictment? And by the way, his co-conspirator was just indicted today down in Florida.
Oh, perhaps a mild difference. I mean, certainly Senator Menendez has been among the, from the White House point of view, on this whole Iran issue, one of the least helpful Democrats. Senator Cardin has not been as far out in front on the sanctions front as Menendez has been. So it's a slight difference, but I think it probably would have come out pretty much the same way.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Paul Pillar, who's a senior fellow at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University. He retired in 2005 from a 28-year career in the U.S. intelligence community as National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia, and is the author of Terrorism and U.S. Foreign Policy and Negotiating Peace, War Termination as a Bargaining Process. And he's a contributing editor to The National Interest, where he has an article, America's Not-So-Ultimate Weapon, Economic Warfare. So when you mentioned a minute ago about the kind of symmetry of hawks on both in Iran and in the United States, and a sort of, I guess there's a kind of symbiosis there. My understanding, though, is that, and I think we all saw the pictures of the rejoicing going on in Tehran when the deal was announced, and they did allow President Obama to go on television uncensored. It seems to me that there is a great deal of pent-up expectation inside of Iran that if those expectations aren't met, won't that cause this unpopular government some grief? I mean, it would seem that it could backfire a little bit if the U.S. scuttles the deal, that's a whole other matter.
Well, certainly there are high expectations, and in the short term, that is all the more reason for the Iranian government and for President Rouhani and Foreign Minister Zarif to maintain a pretty firm line on the sanctions relief issue. That is to say, to get more sanctions relief and get it sooner, so that those economic expectations, if they can't be realized, and they're not going to be realized entirely, even with major sanctions relief, at least they can argue that they have done their best to get the most that Iran could get. So, yes, there are high expectations. They will be difficult for anyone to meet, whether it's Rouhani or the hardliners or anyone else. We can expect some very tough bargaining still ahead with regard to the schedule for sanctions relief. And as you probably know, Ian, the particular statements that have been made by each party have led to accusations that we've got disagreement here that's very serious that still has to be resolved with the Iranians. And specifically, there was one statement by the Supreme Leader talking about insisting on full sanctions relief as soon as a deal is concluded, whereas Americans are talking more about a phasing in as the deal is actually implemented. I think there is that is a bridgeable gap. Implementation is not going to take place all at once, and I think the Iranians realize they're not going to get complete sanctions relief with the stroke of a pen once a deal is signed. Nonetheless, there is hard bargaining.
And the president's managed to cut the review date in half from 60 down to 30. He's also still retains his right to relieve the sanctions by executive order, but of course not the Congress has to remove the sanctions that they've imposed. So it's obviously a very a long and a difficult road ahead. But if you could go forward to the end of June, and apparently if the deal's not done by July the 7th, then there's even more of input and review from the Congress. So assuming they get to the point at the end of June of a deal, what do you think the optics are going to be if the whole world, this is the P5 plus one, these are the world's leading powers, have made it this historic agreement with Iran, and the president can't get it through the Congress? I mean, wouldn't...
Then the rest of the world will squarely conclude that it was the United States that killed the deal.
Right.
And that has major implications with regard to any hopes for more sanctions on Iran. Sanctions... anything that Congress tried to do in the way of reinstituted, let alone increased sanctions, it would be doing pretty much on its own, since even our European allies, not to mention the Russians and the Chinese and others, would be able to say quite honestly, we had a deal and it was the U.S. Congress that killed it.
And would this mean then that the rest of the world could go ahead and relieve the sanctions and start trading with Iran and that the U.S. would be left out in the cold?
Yes, it would mean exactly that. And we would have a new United Nations Security Council resolution. And regardless of what the Congress does, it cannot compel the administration to veto any one new Security Council resolution. And I would have a hard time thinking the Obama administration would veto a new resolution that would reflect and, in effect, implement from the United Nations point of view the deal that had just been struck, and with that new resolution, then everyone, including not just the rest of the P5 plus one, but the rest of the world, can say we're following the revised structure as the Security Council has set it up, and we're doing business with Iran.
So in this compromise deal that between the White House and Senator Caucus Committee, it seems that Marco Rubio and Barrasso and Isaacson and other conservative senators who wanted to insert things, Rubio wanted to insert the demand that Iran recognize Israel. They've been sort of told to sort of they've been put in abeyance, I guess. But you get the feeling that that's all going to come back, and I'm wondering about, for example, recently, the former head of the Israeli Mossad, Efraim Halevi, wrote an article praising this deal and condemning Prime Minister Netanyahu for opposing it. And he ended up by concluding that if the deal doesn't go through, then it's a victory for the Hawks and it means war. And he almost suggested that that was their intention. So do you think that can resonate at all, given obviously the influence that Israel has, having had Prime Minister Netanyahu over here invited by the Republicans to speak, and then the letter that was sent by the 47 Republican senators to the Supreme Leader, and then Senator McCain going public and almost wishing that the Israelis started to bomb the place?
I think the Israeli Prime Minister and his Republican friends here in Washington have overplayed their hand in a couple of respects, and specifically the ones that you just mentioned, Ian. And that has been noticed, and I think certainly with the letter that Senator Cotton wrote, probably that more than anything else, which was appropriately widely criticized immediately after it was released, has had that sort of effect. You mentioned Mr. Halevy. There have been a number of former senior Israeli security officials who have said similar things that have been quite at odds with Prime Minister Netanyahu's line. My interpretation of what Mr. Netanyahu and his government have been trying to do on this issue, and I haven't seen a more plausible explanation, is that they are motivated not because of a fear of an Iranian nuke, although many Israelis do have a genuine concern about that. If that were really the concern, they should be supporting rather than trying to sabotage a negotiated agreement to assure that we won't have an Iranian nuclear weapon. The interest of that government instead is they want to keep Iran in the international penalty box indefinitely. They don't want Iran as a competitor for regional influence. They don't want to lose the bete noire of Iran, and especially its nuclear issue, as the issue that Mr. Netanyahu and his government continually and repeatedly invoke whenever someone else wants to talk about the occupation in the West Bank and the unresolved Palestinian issue. The immediate Israeli government response is, oh, well, what we really need to talk about, the real threat to the region, is Iran and its nuclear program. That is a set of motivations of trying to keep this issue going forever that is quite contrary to U.S. interests. And it's also contrary, as a statement such as the one you cited from Mr. Halevy indicates, it's contrary to Israel's long-term interest as well.
But surely there are sort of analogies here with the end of the Cold War, and in the sense that at a certain point, pointing missiles at each other, the more nuclear weapons both sides had in the Cold War, the less secure they became. And eventually, a lot of people argue that it was MTV and rock and roll that brought the Berlin Wall down. And clearly, you see in Iran the hunger to be part of the world, that the educated, the business elite, the students, the women, the educated, they all want this deal to go through. And my sense is, having talked to a lot of Middle East experts, most of whom actually speak Arabic, you know, people like Graham Fuller and Bob Mayer and Juan Cole, a lot of the feeling is that at the end of the day, the Iranians do have a form of, it's called the Islamic Republic. They do have a form of political Islam. It is, there are recognitions of women. There's a possibility of reform there compared to, say, the Saudis, who, in effect, Israel's in bed with. Many people argue that their religious ideology is also, you know, indistinguishable from Boko Haram and Al Qaeda and the self-declared Islamic State. So this is a long-winded way of saying a lot of people think that at the end of the day we might be better off with the Shia than the Sunni.
Well, I think we don't want to take sides in Middle East sectarian disputes. That's not in U.S. interest. It is in U.S. interest to be able to do business with and have full relations and full discussions with people on all sides of the conflicts in the Middle East, and that certainly includes Iran, the second most populous country in the region. It's going to be an important country, whether somebody else wants it in a penalty box or not. And you touched on a couple of other things. In many respects, there is a lot more progressivism, despite the religious ideology that still undergirds the Islamic Republic of Iran. I was just yesterday in a conversation with a senior Iranian official, along with his wife, who has been somewhat of an activist for on gender-related issues in Iran. And it was pointed out to me that when you look at, for example, the prevalence of women in education and in entering positions in professions, particularly where they get underrepresented here in our country, the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, that especially in engineering, you have about the highest representation of women in Iran as you do in just about any other country in the world. Certainly, their democracy is highly imperfect, with the vetting of candidates by the Guardian Council and the particular role that the Supreme Leader plays. But you have to say, if you look around the region, when you take into account the absolute monarchies of the Gulf countries, when you take into account the situation in the Palestinian territories with people not having political rights, Iran is actually one of the more democratic countries in the region. If I had to pick one country in the whole region that's most democratic right now, I'd probably say Tunisia. And Iran's behind them, but ahead of a whole lot of others, including the Gulf Arabs.
But I guess the point is that Iran has, do you agree that Iran has a greater potential for change and evolution away from its hard line?
Yes, and we've already seen a lot of that in the 3.5 decades of the Islamic Republic's existence. What observers note in terms of just the social mores and dress and culture and so on. And that is something to build on and to exploit. And if we do have a successful nuclear deal, which would be an opening step toward a more normal set of dealings between Iran and the West, including the United States, then we will have those cultural influences that you mentioned were true of the Soviet Union during the Cold War. We will have, I think, all the more of a chance of an evolution politically, culturally, and socially in Iran that would be in directions that are very favorable from our point of view.
But all this hangs in the balance, even though the White House, I think, is trying to put a good face on this. Essentially, the president's had to cave in and have a lot of people looking over his shoulder.
Unfortunately, and yes, there are other negatives on this, Ian. I think one of the biggest ones is not the specific poison pills in the legislation itself, but rather the fact that he has had to make this concession. The Iranians will no doubt notice that and be concerned about it. I think it has complicated the remaining negotiations. It will make the Iranians that much more wary of making more concessions because they are that much more wary that Mr. Obama will be able to carry his side of the deal through to completion. And this, I think, is part of the reason why opponents of the deal have been pushing this legislation or some version of it so hard. To the extent it does complicate the negotiations so much that there might not be an agreement by the 1st of July, then that's mission accomplished from the deal killer's point of view. And even if they don't accomplish that mission, then what the legislation does is encourage Congress to make this quickie, hasty vote in which the deal has much less success of getting an endorsement than if you let it play out, let it be implemented over a period of 6 months, a year, 2 years. Then it would be much harder for those who are opposed to the deal to kill it if it was successful and the Iranians continued to observe its terms.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Paul Piller.
It's my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Paul Piller, who's a senior fellow at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University. He retired in 2005 from a 28-year career in the U.S. intelligence community as National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. He's the author of Terrorism and U.S. Foreign Policy and Negotiating Peace, War Termination as a Bargaining Process, and is a contributing editor to The National Interest, where he has an article, America's Not-So-Ultimate Weapon, Economic Warfare. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the sentences handed down to the Blackwater mercenaries on the very day that the Iraqi prime minister shows up in Washington.
But the Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They got to get together or disintegrate. A whole list truth to be self-evident that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He is the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had firsthand perspectives on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young Pelton.
Hey, how you doing?
And you spent a lot of time in Iraq with the Blackwater mercenaries, and you've written about, obviously, about the whole issue of military contractors in your book, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. You also know Eric Prince, the former head of, or he's the head of what it used to be Blackwater. It's changed its names a few times. I believe you're suing him at the moment. So, let's start with that. Are these guys taking the fall for Eric Prince?
Yeah, I mean, the sentencing is extremely harsh and used penalties designed to stop gang owners from using machine guns. It's obviously a contentious case because this was the white-hot focal point of the U.S. involvement in Iraq, and of course the Iraqis' concerns with a lot of abuses of civil rights, human rights. It was a long time coming. You know, it wasn't like this wasn't going to happen. But at the same time, there were numerous companies that operated in this fashion. Blackwater at that time was working for the State Department and the CIA and other groups. But, you know, this is sort of one of those things that is going, you knew this was going to happen. It happened, but it doesn't actually solve the problem. We still have more contractors working in more countries working for the Department of State. And as you know from the whole Benghazi debacle, this is never going to go away.
So is there a defense here? All of these fellows said many of them said that they were shot at. One of the main people that testified against them was one of their fellow Blackwater guards who got some kind of immunity, and he absolutely laid it on the line that they just indiscriminately shot a bunch of innocent civilians. There were Iraqis there who'd lost children, etc., testifying, and apparently it was fairly moving testimony. And, of course, now you've got Blackwater itself producing radio logs saying that the guards took incoming fire. So how clear is this? It's always seemed pretty clear that this was a reckless, wanton act of murder.
Yeah, okay, you have to remember that these things are complex. It wasn't a simplistic thing. These guys didn't get out of bed and go decide to shoot up Mr. Square. What happened was that the State Department used Blackwater to escort their employees to all the meetings, whether they be major or minor meetings. That morning they were escorting a sort of junior-level person, a State Department employee, to a meeting. They were told that morning that there were two car bombs, both in white vehicles, what they call VBIEDs, that were going to be targeted against State Department employees. So they had that information. They drove to the meeting. A bomb went off. Now, they made their first mistake. So when a bomb goes off, you're not supposed to rush outside and take your client with you. You're supposed to stay in the building until either the military shows up or, you know, the all clear sounded. So the State Department made a major mistake, and the agent in charge, or AIC, decided to move the principal immediately after the car bomb. And in order to move that person back into the green zone, they called for backup. Now, that backup is the group of guys that I spent a month with running Red Irish. Not the same people, but the same basic idea. And it's called a quick reaction force, and it's a group of Riva armored vehicles with machine guns on top and, of course, men inside with M4s. So they were asked to block a traffic circle so that this State Department person could get back to the green zone. This group of Rivas went out to Mr. Square, which, of course, is a traffic circle. They began taking incoming fire immediately. Now, if you're in an armored vehicle, you can hear it. You know, bangs against the side of the vehicle. They had contemporaneous radio logs reporting 8 minutes of incoming weapons, including a mortar, a large explosive. And you can see one of the cars actually has a mortar hole in the roof, which is very difficult to do from a rifle. So what happened then is that these people began shooting back at a Kia, which was a white, looked like a Toyota. It was a white vehicle. It started moving slowly towards one of the vehicles. And I guess they lost it. They just started shooting indiscriminately while they were being shot by a police watchtower next to the square. So did they do something wrong? Absolutely. They used excessive force. Were they allowed to do that? Yes, they were. You know, who did they work for? They worked for the State Department. So there's a complexity there. But the bottom line is that when the Iraqi government said, okay, Blackwater's banned, they don't have a license anymore, the truth was that Blackwater didn't need a license. They were actually guarding the State Department. In other words, it was a diplomatic function, but then the U.S. government found themselves unable to move or function.
So it seems like this long prosecution has been a bit of a battle between the FBI and the Justice Department. So who within the government bureaucracy thinks these guys deserve it? And obviously a lot of people also think they don't deserve it, including, of course, the defendants, one of whom got life and three of whom got 30 years.
Yeah, keep in mind that both Hillary Clinton and President Obama used these same people either in, DSS, the State Department, or as contractors when they traveled to hostile regions. The problem was is that at that time, the Bush administration was heavily dependent on armed contractors to just function in Iraq with what we call our forward-leaning diplomacy. You can't take a 25-year-old Yale graduate and make him drive around Baghdad. So they all had these convoys of armed men. And, of course, insurgents were trying to kill these same people. There were numerous incidents of violence. In the month I spent with Blackwater running up and down Red Irish, you know, we used the machine gun like a car horn. You know, it was just how you got through car bombs and explosions. But is that the proper way for the U.S. to conduct themselves in foreign countries? No, not at all. So,
well, there must have been a whole bunch of Iraqis killed. I mean, Red Irish was the route from the airport into the green zone, right?
Yeah, yeah, and it was a very short ride, but yes, of course, a lot of Iraqi civilians were murdered, they were run over. I mean, I spent a lot of time in Sadr City talking to people who had been, you know, their families had been killed and wounded by contractors. And keep in mind, nobody knew who Blackwater was because they didn't carry any vehicle identification, but there were, you know, up to 100,000 contractors in Iraq. So this was really a witch hunt to put a stake through the heart of specifically Arab Prince's company and Blackwater, but all these people began working simply as Triple Canopy and as other companies. So it wasn't like we got rid of the problem. We just basically put Eric Prince out of business.
Well, he ended up a billionaire, didn't he?
That's right. So he complained to me that he wished he'd charged more money and that he wished he'd never worked for the State Department. You know, he enjoyed working for the CIA because it was somewhat, you know, secretive, but now he's off working for the Chinese. But the point was is that he didn't create his company. The CIA and the Bush administration and the State Department created Blackwater.
Right. And are you still suing him, or what's going on with that?
Yeah, Eric asked me to help him fix his autobiography. Eric's not that good at writing. And I said, sure, if you tell the truth, I'm happy to let you tell your side of the story. Because, you know, he's a much maligned person, and he's done some bad things, and he's done some good things. And he and I got into a disagreement, and he basically decided he wasn't going to pay me for some things I did for him. So basically, I'm suing him to collect money. He's paid some of his bills, but in Loudoun County, you can read all the depositions in which he has a very bad memory of things. But, you know, I don't have a personal vendetta against Eric. You know, I'm a journalist. I believe in writing the truth and communicating the truth.
Right, but you got to make a living, and he's worth a fortune. So,
I got him a $2 million deal on his book, so he should be a very happy man. He shouldn't be so stingy.
Right. Well, obviously, Robert Young Pelton, again, author, filmmaker, journalist, explorer, and the author of License to Kill, Hired Guns, and The War on Terror. It's a highly coincidental, isn't it, that the Iraqi leader shows up today, the day after the sentencing. And I know it's a big deal in Iraq, isn't it? I mean, the Iraqi people didn't think the Americans would ever do this. And apparently the fact that the U.S. has brought these people to account, that's apparently means a lot in Iraq.
Yeah, I wish it wasn't so damn blatantly obvious, because the bottom line, and you can draw a through line from what happened with Mr. Square and the status of forces agreement and the fact that the Americans eventually pulled out of Iraq, which led Maliki to turn to Iran for support, which is what created the Anbaris, the Sunnis in the north, to get cut off their allowances, which is why they invited in ISIS. So all these events are related. So if you draw a through line, this is supposed to be sort of closing a chapter. And, of course, they're back fighting a war in Iraq, and things seem like they're just going right back to the way they were. But this Blackwater incident triggered the inability of the U.S. government to function inside Iraq, and also led to essentially the removal of all major U.S. forces out of Iraq and the entry of Iran.
And Abadi, of course, is a nobody. He's not really in charge. Maliki's still in charge behind the scenes. He stole, 30, 40, 60 billion of the oil revenues and has created private armies who are killing the Sunni as they liberate these Sunni cities. I mean, the place is a complete mess.
Right, and so by the public burning of these Blackwater guards, it's not fixing Iraq. It does not repair what we did to the Iraqi people when we invaded that country under false pretenses. So this is just a pathetic show trial to let everybody know that, look, we can't tolerate human right abuses. These people did not set out to murder anyone. They're all former U.S. servicemen. They were working for the U.S. government. It was just very convenient for the U.S. government to throw these people under the bus because everybody hated Blackwater, and these guys were caught red-handed in a very violent event.
But this is not to say, Robert Young Pelton, that we're out of Iraq, right? I mean, everybody's talked about this great big spring offensive. They're going to retake Mosul in April. We're already in April. They didn't actually have an easy time of taking to Crete. This thing could go on for a while, right?
And who do you think is training Iraqi troops? Who do you think is supporting U.S. efforts in Iraq? These are contractors again. I mean, the concept of having ex-military or people work as contractors supporting up our efforts overseas has not changed one iota. So I just think this is a lot of smoke and mirrors to make us think that we've killed the bad Blackwater. We've killed contractors, but we haven't. They're actually much more necessary in these sort of covert, secretive wars.
Well, Robert Young Pelton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, always, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Young Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had firsthand perspectives on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about how the Republicans are giving an extraordinary gift to the richest 1% of the 1% of Americans.
The Patient Millions, put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. school books, beds in hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All I get is old men grinding.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Chuck Ma, who's the Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 1999 through 2004, he was Economic Policy Advisor to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle and Senior Advisor for Budget Policy at the National Economic Council during the second term of President Clinton. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chuck Ma.
Oh, thanks for having me in.
And the House Republicans this week are going to give this extraordinary gift to the richest Americans. And they've been working on this for the longest time. And obviously, it would, at this point, indicating by what happened with the committee that voted it to the full Congress, no Democrats voted for the GOP bill, which has been called the Death Tax Repeal Act of 2015. But nevertheless, it strikes me as a fairly brazen payoff to the wealthiest Americans. Is this a move further in this country away from democracy towards plutocracy?
Well, it's a curious juxtaposition. If you think about it, you know, tomorrow is April 15th. So you have Americans across the country rushing to file their taxes, pay their taxes. And what this bill would do actually is it eliminates the estate tax. But it actually it keeps in place this loophole that deals with the taxation of capital gains on appreciated assets. So in effect, what it does for the wealthiest people in the country is they will be able to go through their entire lives having much of their asset, much of their income from assets never taxed, and then hand that money down on a completely tax-free basis. So you can have successive generations of people, you know, the wealthiest people in the country living and never paying any taxes. It's extraordinary. They've been pushing this for the estate tax repeal for many years, but this is actually the most radical of the proposals that they've ever made.
So just in terms of the estate tax, this only applies to about 4,700 estates, according to the Joint Committee on Taxation in 2013. And at this moment, only estates belonging to individuals with a worth over $5.43 million can be taxed. And for a couple, that's $10.86 million. So, in other words, this tax only applies to people above that threshold. And this is what's so extraordinary. Apparently, the statistics indicate that these people, which are clearly the 0.1 of 1% of Americans, are over 15,700% richer than the median American household. And yet, they don't pay tax. And on April the 15th, the rest of us pay tax.
You know, this is definitely the wealthiest of the wealthy. And again, right, so, you know, most of these estates, as you say, millions of dollars. And for the ones, you know, this tax really is on those at the very top. And in the picture, the estates would tax with estates worth over $100 million, right, which is really the main folks that pay the estate tax, over $100 million. Again, half of the money in their estates that would go down tax-free has never been taxed before. And so this is something that can go from generation to generation completely tax-free.
Well, this is what gets to my point about, you know, the drift away from democracy towards plutocracy. I mean, my understanding is that the founding fathers of this country wanted to create a meritocracy, not an aristocracy. After all, the American Revolution was fought to get rid of the British-imposed aristocracy.
You know, what's curious is if you look historically, the first estate tax, I believe, was begun around the Civil War to help pay for the Civil War for the Union Army. And it's been part of the law since then for a very long time. It really is one of our oldest taxes, most progressive taxes. So to get rid of it actually would be quite the U-turn from history.
So in terms of, explain further, though, this extra generous loophole that the Republican Congress is giving the uber wealthy, where not only do they not pay any estate tax, they essentially don't have to pay any capital gains tax. They can roll over the entire estate to their heirs.
Sure.
Without...
Yeah, sure. So picture you're an average American, right, going to work every day. You get a paycheck every 2 weeks. And every 2 weeks, the federal government, you know, takes out money for your federal income taxes, for your pay, you know, for your Social Security taxes, your Medicare taxes, your state income taxes. That's how most people, you know, sort of pay their taxes and how their finances are dealt with. But for affluent people, more wealthy people in particular, they get a large share of their income comes not from labor income, but from capital income. And so a lot of this comes from the appreciation of assets. So picture someone who goes out and spends, you know, buys $1 million worth of a particular stock, right? Buys some stock in a company for $1 million when they're like 30 years old. And over time, that $1 million grows and grows and grows. They hold on to the stock, and then when they're 70 years old, say that stock could be up in the range of $10 million. So say it's $5 million by then, right? And so as they get older and they hit 80 years old, it's worth $7 million, right? And so they get ready, and if they hold on to that when they die and give that to their children, right? It's worth $7 million. So that income that they've earned from $7 million to less $1 million when they originally bought it for, that $6 million of gain is never taxed, because capital gains are kind of a voluntary tax. You don't tax until you sell. But there's this loophole that says the tax gets wiped out when one dies. So you have $6 million in gain that's never been taxed, and then it goes to the heir, and then the heir pays no estate tax and then pays also no income tax on that money. And so you start to think about, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars on these very large estates flowing like that, and it's really is this sort of this tax benefit not taxed during life, not taxed at transfer from an estate, and not taxed as income to the heir. And again, you just get this sort of generation after generation of tax-free money flowing, a large amount of money.
And again, I'm speaking with Chuck Maher, who's the Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 1999 through 2004, he was Economic Policy Advisor to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle and Senior Advisor for Budget Policy at the National Economic Council during the second term of President Clinton. So this will cost the Federal Treasury, right, something like $269 billion over the next 10 years, according to the Congressional Budget Office?
That's correct. Yes, I mean, the estate tax, you know, it is still a large amount of money, although the estate tax has been whittled down. It would, you know, a few years ago, it would have cost a lot more to get rid of it. But right now, yeah, about $250 billion.
And the point about capital gains is that half of all capital gains go to the richest, 0.1%. That's the 1% of the 1%
right.
of Americans.
Yeah, yeah. Wealth is, you know, income in the United States is very concentrated, but wealth is extremely concentrated, right? So most capital gains, it's astounding. If you look at even the richest, the wealthiest 400 people in the country, the IRS publishes their tax returns each year, and each year, roughly $1 in $9 of every capital gains in a country of 300 million people flows to that just 400 people. So capital gains are extremely concentrated.
But they're taxed at just 20%, which is well below what the rest of us have to pay, which is 39.6%.
Right. So you get the capital gains get several advantages, right? Capital gains are only taxed sort of when the assets are sold. So there's a timing question that sort of is left to the holder. And it's also they get enjoy, as you say, a lower rate compared to comparable labor income. Then they also get this loophole at the end at death that the capital gains are wiped out. So there's many, many advantages for capital gains.
So the richest 0.1% get taxed at 20% on capital gains, while the rest of us are close to 40% on our ordinary income. And then when you add that to the estate tax, which only applies to 0.2%, so that's 2% of the 1%, the rate is supposedly, 40%, but the effective rate is less than 17%. So how do you have a formal 40% rate yet an effective rate of less than 17%.
Right. Well, you have as we talked about in the beginning, there's a very large tax-free exemption, right? It's a $10 million exemption per couple. Plus, there are many, many easy ways to manipulate the estate tax. You can set up certain kind of trust funds that can sort of undervalue assets. You get special valuation rules, and there's all kinds of the things that that lawyers can figure out. So it's relatively easy to shelter quite a bit of money on the estate tax. So the effective rate is well below the statutory 40%.
So when you say that they've been whittling away at the estate tax for years and years, it's been a concerted effort. Who has, I mean, I can answer my own question. Who has been behind it? I'd say the wealthiest families, right?
Right.
It's been a
broad-based effort, but there has been certainly a lobbying campaign by the wealthiest families in the country that's been pretty well documented. But what's been is it's in most every major tax bill since it started in 1997. So if you go back to 1997, right, you have President Clinton and the Republican Congress. So there was a negotiation around a balanced budget agreement, and the President Clinton's priority was to get health care for low-income children, right, the CHIP program. So he was able to secure that. In return, the Republicans insisted on getting cut in the estate tax. It's the same way with President Obama. You know, in 2012, the President Obama was trying to secure his increases, improvements in the earned income tax credit for working poor people, and the Republicans insisted that there be, a tax cut for more trust fund type kids, right, and with the estate tax, and they were able to raise the tax-free exemption. So pretty much since 1997, every major tax bill, there has been an effort on one side to secure a weakening of the estate tax.
So, in other words, the Republicans go to bat for the point one.
I'm not saying they're not alone. There certainly have been Democrats.
Right.
But as a general matter, just more generally, that there has been a big priority for them. And you'll see that in the campaign. You'll see all these proposals will come out from the Republican candidates, and most of them will eliminate the estate tax. I think Senator Rubio is already out. I think he's the first one that's called for that.
Right. But essentially they're going to bat for the 0.1 or the 0.2 of the 1%. And that's an extraordinary priority for any American to be more concerned about the 0.1 or 0.2% of the 1% as opposed to the 99.98%.
Right. Well, particularly in these times, right, one would think that this would be the last time, given how incomes have become so polarized and wealth has become so polarized, one would think there'd be a push to have a more robust estate tax, right? I mean, but.
So what's your explanation, though, for the brazen nature of it? I mean, I'm not aware of any Democrats, and face it, there's only one at this point running, or that maybe there's two or three running, but the most prominent candidate being Hillary Clinton. Obviously, she's only started 2 days ago. But where is the pushback? Is there? Because I would think that if the average American was paying attention, and particularly tomorrow when they have to pay their taxes, there's a sense in this country, surely, of a fairness that we're supposed to be a meritocracy. And yet, if you just pass on wealth to heirs, you create a whole new aristocracy that doesn't have to perform. They simply beneficials of an accident of birth.
Yeah, no, it is perplexing. I mean, I think it does show that sort of persistence pays off, right? I think this push for drumbeat for many years has helped move it along. And I think there's confusion about, who pays the estate tax, I think, is part of it. I think the other side has made a sort of moral argument on it that has resonated with some people, right, that death should not be a taxable event. And I think that is, if you think about it, you have a wealthy person who's born, and it's, just sort of a luck of the draw, and, people pay tax on lotteries, and a person wins out of a birth lottery, inherits hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. It's really not much to ask them to pay 20% tax. I mean, it's, everybody pays taxes. But again, so it's been sort of this aggressive push, and the pushback has been there, but it hasn't been as strong, and so over time, you've had this whittling down.
Well, is it about semantics? I mean, let's face it, the Republicans framing this as the death tax.
I think that certainly has helped them. I think there's also confusion. I think most people think that when you inherit millions of dollars, that person pays income tax on that money, right? I don't think that people understand that the heir does not pay tax on that money, right? So I think people assume that it's been taxed, and I think most people have no idea that the money has never been taxed before, right? Because if you listen to the other side, they'll say, "Oh, this is like double taxation, triple taxation," right? They don't say that much of this money has never been taxed before. So, you know, I think it's incumbent on us to make that point. But I don't think people understand. This is fully understood that a lot of this money has never been taxed and that it won't be taxed, right? This means, you know, they don't pay income taxes. They haven't paid income tax before. The heir won't pay income taxes. So really it is just a transfer, of massive tax-free transfer. And I think if they understood that they would have a problem with it.
But in terms of the capital gains aspect, where they already pay half of what the average person pays, and there are also ways, I think, to even reduce that tax bill. You know, for example, the Koch brothers, who are very active in politics, and they organized a retreat recently down here in Newport Beach with a whole bunch of fellow billionaires and millionaires, and pledged, I think, up almost $1 billion to defeat Hillary Clinton in this upcoming 2016 campaign. They inherited wealth from their father. Now they, you know, I think a couple of billion or something, and they've run it up to about $100 billion. But most of their wealth has been generated through capital gains on Wall Street. They've literally been playing the market for decades and decades. So is this what's happened to America, that the power has shifted from Washington to Wall Street, and then Wall Street calls the tune? Because if you can get the Republican Party to carry your water for you and even do something as brazen as what they're trying to do now, and, you know, it would indicate to me where the real power in this country lies.
Well, I think it's, you know, I think it's hard for me to say, but I do think that, again, this does affect so few people, and it is perplexing that, you know, you do have, and when you have this major debate on tax policy, you have two sides sitting at the table, it's just unfortunate that one side has put the top priority on reducing this tax, right? It really has been the top priority for a very long time. And that's, you know, again, you're leaving out, right, in a country of 350 million people, you're leaving out most of them.
And for those who advocate for the most of us, curiously enough, it doesn't seem like the average American is lighting a fire under them, saying, wait a minute, this is unfair. We're paying twice the taxes,
right,
of the uber rich. And, you know, it's not right. It's not the way the country was meant to be. It's not the American dream. It's not the Horatio Alger. It's not the meritocracy that the founding fathers envisaged. I mean,
right. No, there's no doubt about it. This is really placing inherited wealth at an advantage. And there, you know, has not been as much of a pushback as one would expect.
All righty. Well, I guess
keep fighting it.
Maybe tomorrow. Maybe
yeah. Yeah, you know,
people get.
It's not going to make it through this time. So there's, you know, it should spark more opposition than it does, and hopefully it will.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Chuck Maher.
Oh, thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Chuck Maher, who's a director of federal tax policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 1999 through 2004, he was economic policy advisor to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle and senior advisor for budget policy at the National Economic Council during the second term of President Bill Clinton. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.